Hey, this is Future Thinkers, where we talk about how to adapt to a changing world, build more resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose. With your hosts, Mike Gilliland and Yuvi Ivanova.
We've decided to put our weekly John Vervaeke lectures on hold for now and instead do some live streams where Yuvi and I will attempt to make sense of what is happening in the world right now and figure out what people can do about it. You can join us every Monday at 9 a.m. PST, 5 p.m. GMT on YouTube by going to futurethinkers.org/live. We have a new membership level on our site, where for only $5 a month, you can get access to archives of our live streams, full podcast episodes, and unreleased material from past podcast episodes. You can check that out by going to members.futurethinkers.org to sign up. So I'm noticing a lot of change in myself and in society and how it's looking at this thing as it's unfolding. Like, it's a lot different than how I would have predicted something like this would have unfolded.
Mm. In what way?
Speed of response in some ways. Like, once people... this is the big problem. Once people come to grips with the actual problem, they do something about it. They really will jump up and do something. But like I said, the avoidance of coming to grips and accepting something like this is what delays and creates all the problems that we're seeing in Western society. Like, I know the kind of American spirit or Canadian, you know, North American, and basically Western country, like the spirit of take care of yourself, take care of others, do what is necessary, be pragmatic. I know that sense of identity comes up in crisis situations. Like, I've seen enough, you know, emergency situations, car accidents, pileups, like people needing immediate emergency care. And I've seen how, like, complete strangers and people off the street just jump up and help. So I think that's kind of an American way or Western way of doing things. Like, we will jump up and help if we come to grips with the facts about this situation. So speed, I guess I'm a little surprised at how slow the response has been, how slow people are to come to grips with it. And I'm also surprised at how fast the response is in other ways, like how many YouTube channels have popped up with really, really good information. Dr. Jonathan Campbell, was it?
John Campbell, yeah.
He's one guy. He's a... I think he worked for the CDC, or he's a...
he's British.
Yeah, medical profession anyway. He does daily YouTube videos where he goes over all of the stats, all of the infection rates, everything, and what you should do and what to expect and this kind of stuff to do with the infection.
Very level-headed, very measured, very pragmatic information.
So I've been impressed with channels like that have popped up, and people are actually communicating now daily and kind of increasing the feed of information. Because one thing, as we've discussed quite a lot in our group calls, is that the whole idea of our models of reality and civilization falling apart puts people into existential crisis. And especially the idea that you might have to, like, redo your map, your map of reality, your map of how you expect things to work daily.
Yeah.
Like, people brought up how just horrific that is, how much, you know, inner nervousness and kind of existential crisis that puts people into. Admitting to yourself that you don't know what's coming next, and admitting that your sources of information and the things you've relied on, the pillars of what you expected civilization was built upon, are collapsing around you. It's like suddenly you feel like you're strapped to the hood of a car. You don't know where you're going. You're just flying. And so this is something that we've talked about a lot in the past as being an important thing to get used to.
Uncertainty
and comfort with ambiguity.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. So I'd love to...
It's interesting that you bring up people's maps kind of falling apart. And I find this to be quite a privileged position, you know, that people...
to have a map to begin with.
Yeah, people have lived in these countries that have been very, very safe, very stable for a long time. And historically, this is actually very anomalous.
Yeah.
This was kind of a... you could say it was a 20th century phenomenon, that... and even the second half of 20th century, that... economies were stable, that, you know, countries were safe and people's lives didn't get uprooted for generations. But I don't think that it's a normal thing in history.
Yeah.
And I think that these kinds of black swan events are going to increase.
It relates to our ability to also trust ourselves to respond to crisis or to the demands of real-time reality in the moment. Like, we don't trust ourselves anymore because we've been out of practice with being in real-time reality for a long time. But we've evolved to be actually pretty damn good at that. I mean, we're very good hunters. We're very good at tracking moving objects. We're very good at responding and thinking quickly and being adaptive in the moment. But Western civilization in a lot of ways has just kind of...
made people into indoor cats?
Indoor cats, yeah. I was going to say it's broken our ability, but I don't believe that it's broken. I just think, yeah, yeah. You can see it. Anyone who hasn't traveled, I mean, there's that kind of false sense of security. That's another thing, that false sense of security, which creates that greater distance to fall when your maps no longer seem to work anymore. When you've got really solid faith in government and society and
stock market.
Exactly, that kind of stuff. Yeah, when it actually falls, it's like, holy shit. If you weren't expecting that black swan event to ever happen, it's horrific. Yeah. So, but I mean, that's what I'm kind of saying is Western society has built us up for these kind of surprise moments to black swan events. When I think we've got some pretty good evolutionary history to be able to be more adaptive.
Yeah. So why don't we talk about the actual societal implications of this thing? Why, you know, why we're talking about it? What are some of the things that are already happening? And this is not even speculative. The things that are already happening as a result of this. Well, one we already brought up is that because of the speed of infection, the hospitals are getting overwhelmed. So people say, oh, this is just the flu, or like way more people die of the flu or of heart disease every year. Well, the thing is, the medical system is built for those things. We know that this many people die of the flu, this many people die of heart disease every year.
Even then, so, it's not really doing a good job of that in a lot of places.
Yeah, but still, the medical system can support that at least to some degree. Now it's happening all at once. And so the analogy here is that a tidal wave is not the same as a tsunami, even though the amount of water might be the same.
Yeah, you were saying that earlier. What does that mean?
So this is something from epidemiology that I've been educated on in recent weeks, is that you can imagine like a wave, right? If the wave is really steep and it comes all at once and the hospital capacity is like a vertical line, the wave will exceed the hospital capacity by a lot. Mm-hmm. And so the people who need medical care to survive, which with the COVID-19 is something like 20% of people need medical attention in order to survive, 5% are absolutely critical. Like they need lung ventilation. They can't breathe without medical assistance. And so because hospital beds and doctors and ventilators are limited, if that capacity gets exceeded, then a lot more people die. If you can flatten that wave, if it doesn't go over the hospital capacity, just maybe touches it, then way fewer people survive. Mm-hmm. So if you spread, if the epidemic spreads slower, then you're able to treat those same number of people just over a longer period of time that you don't exceed the hospital capacity.
Right.
So, and that's why we see such a big difference in fatality rates in Wuhan, which is where it started, and in other provinces in China, because the other provinces were able to implement quarantine measures and reduce the spread of the virus and thereby extend the, you know, the duration of that wave so that the hospitals can keep up with the patients. And so fewer people died, significantly fewer people died.
On that note, it is interesting how fast this totalitarian government has been able to adapt to this whole situation. That China's got the power and the ability to make people listen. And the other thing that's notable is that people are actually buying into the quarantine measures.
Mm-hmm.
We're not really doing that in the West.
No, and it's not even possible.
Yeah.
So this is a really, it's a challenging topic to talk about. So how much government intervention is appropriate? Because at first, you know, when China started, they were really censoring the information. They were punishing doctors who were trying to tell the West about what was going on. And then they clued in and then they implemented these quarantine measures and it actually worked. So, yes, of course, that is, you know, really crappy to people on a personal level. It has emotional costs. People can't go to work. You know, they can't go about their normal social lives. Maybe they're cut off from their families. But on a
people who are traveling as well are stuck in certain locations.
Yeah, people might be stuck. But on a big scale, it did prevent a lot of deaths.
Yeah.
And it prevented a lot of other fallout things that could have happened that we are now seeing happening in places like Iran that didn't implement these measures. So some measures that might seem very draconian actually have ended up having very good outcomes. So, and it's difficult to say what is better because now that China has implemented these measures, they have a precedent to do it again for something else.
Western countries as well can look at China's response to this and be like, we need to do something like this.
But yeah, so in Western countries, there's too much of a sense of liberty and people simply won't listen. They won't do it. And another thing is that in China, they have the social credit score system. So every person has a social credit score. And if they don't listen to a quarantine, I'm sure there are repercussions. Mm. You know, they won't be able to get credit. They may not be able to even buy train tickets or get a job or sign a lease on an apartment. So there are real life consequences. Whereas in Western countries, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. So these kinds of measures, these strict quarantine measures, simply will not work in the West. People just won't listen.
Something else that has come up for me watching the John Campbell videos, he had mentioned that in America, there's not enough testing kits and people aren't able to be diagnosed. So it looks like the spread rate is really low when actually it's probably multiples higher than it is. And one thing that struck me about the American medical system is that to go to the hospital, to go through quarantine, you're probably going to have to pay a lot of money.
Yeah.
So there's this whole disincentivization to be quarantined and to get proper medical care. I know you can self-quarantine at home, but...
you're absolutely right. And people who have the luxury to work from home, who work in tech or some other, you know, knowledge work. That's great, you know, and a lot of companies are encouraging people to work from home. And that's one of the potential positive outcomes of this is that telecommuting and working from home is going to become more accepted, which of course means people can be closer to their families. And there are a lot of benefits to this. Mm-hmm. But there are also a lot of people who work in service professions, you know, at gas stations, restaurants, food prep, whatever, where they are there in person and they can't work from home.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time they're not even, they don't even get days off. Or if they do get a day off, they get fired or they're threatened to be fired. So I've heard Twitter has actually been a really excellent source for hearing what is actually happening on the ground. And there's lots of these stories coming out now where, you know, people are saying, well, in the restaurant industry, everybody goes to work sick. They just take whatever kind of medication they need to mask the symptoms and they go into work sick because if they don't show up, they get fired.
Yep.
And so what's happening is that, you know, if they're in the early stages of the disease or if they're young and, you know, maybe have the milder version, they're just going around spreading it to everybody. And because first of all, they don't want to get fired. And secondly, they can't afford to get tested or take time off.
I feel like, you know, remember that discussion we had a few days ago with our friend David after, I think, one of our group calls, might have been after the Verbeke live stream. And we discussed the potential upsides of this and the idea that the fact that this virus is it's milder than it could have been. The death rate could have been a lot higher. I mean, I'm thinking about it. I've just downloaded Plague Inc., the game on my phone recently, and I've been playing around with that and like learning about how viruses spread and how certain symptoms will cause different reactions and society will react and everything too. So it what I'm interested in about this is that it seems like a practice run for something bigger. It's like, it's not super lethal, even though 3-4% is pretty bad. I mean, that's like, what is it, 100 million people if everyone in the world gets affected? Something like that.
I haven't done the math, but...
It's yeah, a lot. It's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, it's many millions of people will die, most likely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I mean... The benefits, let's talk about that, even though that's kind of sketchy territory here. The work from home incentive is going to improve, I think, a lot of people's lives. The ability to work remotely, to maybe be location independent, you know, stuff you and I have experience with since, I don't know, 2013 or something. And that's really changed our lives for the better. And employers that haven't really wanted to do that are potentially more motivated to do that now. So that's an interesting thing. The hyper-centralization of government and medical systems, that's another one. Fragility of supply chains is another one.
Yeah, so hopefully...
So, I mean, it highlights all of these things.
It highlights. So yeah. Hopefully what we will see is more decentralized governance, and the need for that will become obvious. Mm-hmm. Decentralized medicine as well. So why is it that people are relying on the single governing body in the States to provide test kits? And why is the response so slow? Why don't local authorities and local hospitals get the ability to get test kits or have some sort of a test that could be adapted from existing equipment, like what they've done in China? I think they started doing CT scans and looking at people's lungs and diagnosing that way, because then they could... I can't remember. There's a World Health Organization. A bunch of their officials went to China when China finally let them in. And they did a report on what they saw there. And there were some things that were really impressive with what the Chinese were doing. Yeah, they've adapted these CT scans and they were scanning a person every 6 minutes or something like that. They were just like, it was like a factory. They were just scanning so many people. And they were able to diagnose way more patients that way rather than doing these test kits that take several days to get the results. They could get the results right away. So things like that, decentralized medicine. I'm also somebody on Twitter suggested, and I will post links to this with attribution so that I'm not just saying somebody on Twitter, but you can actually see who said it. Somebody on Twitter suggested that we need something like a 23andMe for this virus, where people can send in a saliva swab.
And, oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
And yeah, little innovations like that. I think that's a big opportunity in really, let me be clear. The opportunity I'm seeing is the reflection of our on our own society, on the way our societies are constructed and run. This is the advantage. We actually will potentially start to look at these things. So I don't want to say that, like, yay, this virus is a good thing. I just want to say that becoming conscious of the faults and the flaws and the risks within our system is to me the biggest thing. If we're not aware of it, if we're not looking at it, something like this can make us look at it and then potentially innovate.
Exactly. And this is something that we've talked about lots actually before, is that there needs to be enough evolutionary pressure for systems to change. And a person is also a system.
Yeah.
So for lots of psychologists have come to the same conclusion. The guy who invented spiral dynamics, or the precursor to it, came to the same conclusion that people need enough pressure to change. Like, change has to be inevitable, otherwise people don't change. And something like this is something that makes people change. It makes systems change. It's acute enough, because something very drawn out like climate change is not enough pressure. Well, until there's a tipping point, maybe. But
yeah, that's an unfortunate thing about climate change is looking for evidence in the environment is too late. And mm-hmm. It's kind of the same thing with this. Like, if you're not being proactive, you're fucked.
Yeah.
That's unfortunate. However, the damages from this could be minimal compared to, say, if the death rate was like 40% or something really, really horrible. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so many factors of this virus that are just like the perfect storm, but also kind of like a practice run. You know, the fact that it takes whatever 7 to 20 days to incubate without symptoms, and so you're spreading it around, and then finally you show symptoms, or maybe you don't. but you're still spreading it. That's like, yeah, that's kind of a perfect storm for this to be spread.
Yeah. That said, though, I definitely don't want to downplay, because 2% death rate, or now the new data is showing it's closer to 4% death rate, is still very significant.
Yeah.
So it's not just the death rate. It's also, you also got to look at the morbidity rate. So what that means is that the people who will have permanent damage from this, and there's actually new data coming out that's showing that a lot of people, even young people who might not die, might have permanent lung damage, permanent organ damage, heart damage, infertility.
Infertility in men.
Yeah. And of course, the PTSD from this as well. Like, you know, the trauma that people are going to be exposed to can be very, very significant. You know, like there was just a heart-wrenching story of this Chinese woman who was live tweeting what was happening to her. And she was just like, she was not any kind of a public intellectual or journalist or anything, just a regular person that, you know, tweeted about her or posted on whatever social media network they use in China about her life, you know, her favorite movies or whatever. And then she started posting about this virus and what was happening. And all of a sudden, you know, her father fell sick. And then within 2 days, he was dead. And then her mother also fell sick. Within a couple of days, she was dead. And it just unraveled so quickly. And it was just, you know, heart-wrenching seeing these posts. And these kinds of stories, a bunch of these stories came out, and, you know, we're going to see more of these stories coming out from Western countries, because America is maybe like 7 weeks behind China, behind Wuhan, and what's happening.
Which is really not much. I mean, the speed is just...
Yeah. It might even be less because of they're not implementing quarantine. So it might hit even harder.
Yeah.
So when these, you know, these stories come out and it's somebody you know, or, well, of course, if it's your family, it's really traumatic, but it can also be traumatic if you're just seeing death all around, like different families, your neighbors, you know, it's on the news, it's everywhere. And it does affect people psychologically. So we can't forget about that.
Yeah.
And of course, all the other societal effects, second order effects, you know, the economic downturn. Of course, the stock market doesn't equal the economy, but the stock market is taking a dive, and crypto is taking a dive, and, you know, people might go bankrupt.
I've seen a lot of posts lately of people, even people in our community. One person had posted on Twitter saying their parents now cannot work.
Yeah.
And that they're looking like they can't pay bills, like they don't have a ton of money saved. Right.
Yeah,
and I this is happening. Like my parents are both in the process of retiring. My mom's recovering from cancer, so it's like both there's an immune problem, and then there's the, you know,
age.
Yeah, and the employment factor is a problem as well. Like, there's just so many things. It's like now, you know, they need to be working, and no one's going to be hiring now.
Mm-mm.
Why would you hire now? No one's expanding now. Yeah, so this is going to be serious in a lot of ways. I want to talk about the emotional component a bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How to be kind of emotionally stable, how to be useful, because that's one thing in times of crisis. Having your own kind of emotional stability, not that you're just, you know, pushing everything down and trying to avoid looking at it. That's not what I'm advocating here. But to actually have an efficient processing of your emotions so that you can be useful when other people are going through their own thing. So we've talked about this a ton in the past. It's what our courses and our calls, our private calls, are all about, basically. Mm-hmm. Is how to process difficult emotions and how to speed up that process and be sovereign.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that for a bit?
Sure, let's talk about that.
Because
it is, I'm seeing more and more that people are saying, how do I cope with this?
Yeah.
And now it's still in early-ish phases in the States. So people actually maybe have enough time to learn how to do certain practices.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there is time. There's always time to learn these practices and
couple weeks.
The events. Well, I mean, the events themselves will promote the processing of trauma and of difficult emotions because they force you through it. You need the tools to be able to do it, but some people do it naturally, mm-hmm. you know, figure it out naturally. Some people are maybe a little bit more isolated and this might be a little harder for them. Meditation, certain techniques with meditation, I think are pretty useful. We've talked about these a lot in the past about yeah. emotional processing meditation.
Yeah. And that's basically just allowing yourself to feel difficult emotions, to feel them in your body.
Yeah.
And to accept them.
You know, I'm reminded of a conference I went to last year where we were talking about the kind of sense of urgency and despair about collapse of environment and potential for the collapse of civilizations and this sort of thing. Like, I feel like a lot of people have had this inkling that things are not going well and more things are just cascading and failing around us. Like 2020 has not been very easy so far. You know, the potential of World War III starting day one in January.
Mm.
And then
Australian bushfires.
Oh, yeah, man.
And now this pandemic.
Yeah. So there's so many things cascading in. And I know from what we've discussed in the calls that people are just like, fuck, what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
This is crazy. So there's this, again, there's this upside of this whole thing where it's like cascade of failure. First of all, makes you want to change and makes you have to adapt and learn the skills so that you can be more resilient. Like there's no other option now.
Yeah.
We have to do something.
Yeah.
So good news is that it's actually possible to process this stuff. I don't mean shove it down. Like, oh yeah, the conference. I noticed at this conference that a lot of men were treating the attitude about crisis or what to do about crisis like they treat a lot of their kind of dark emotions, which is not to face them, but to instead shove them down and try and be a leader. And it's really the opposite of processing. So maybe we can talk about that. What's the difference between like compartmentalizing and burying emotions versus processing them? And what are some techniques of processing?
Maybe you can talk about that and speak to men on that okay. note. I think it's a bit easier, at least in Western society, it's more socially acceptable for women to feel and express their emotions.
I still see a lot of unhealthy processing with women, though, too.
Yes, but, yeah, yeah.
Well, okay. I'll speak for men. Maybe you can speak for women here.
Okay.
But I think the process is quite similar. There is a basement to suffering. There's a basement to both physical and emotional and mental suffering. I mean, and I know that because the other side, like the bottom is basically, it's worth it for me to kill myself than to stay with this feeling. It's better if I do that. And I've known a lot of personal close friends who have actually taken that route, and you have too.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there before where it just seemed like, you know, that was such a better option. And for whatever reason, I didn't. There is a basement to these emotions, and there is a light at the end of the tunnel through it. There is something that happens when you sit with these things and you go, okay, this is life now. This is the way it is. Everything is falling apart. Could be any number of things. You use your own examples. My life is falling apart. At least it can't get any worse. You know, that was kind of the attitude I had before. And then it would somehow manage to get worse. But as it got worse, I noticed I wasn't feeling that much worse about it. And hitting the basement, like I say, caused me to start looking at these things because it was like life was forcing me into the situation of having so many things happen. So now I'm just going to look at them and see if I can process them or work through them or make it something feel better. And I noticed that kind of surrender, basically that's all it is surrendering to the emotion that comes in. We have this fear that emotion is going to be our new reality. It's going to be like that forever.
Hmm.
And that's what I discovered by kind of being slammed into the ground was that it doesn't, you can process anything. You can get used to it. You can, there may be dull pain. I mean, you probably wouldn't get used to your spouse or your father or your child dying in a horrific way. Let's just add that in. You're probably going to remember that for a long time, but it will actually get easier. And it just never seems like that, you know. So sitting with that emotion is, in surrendering to that emotion, is the way, that's the path forward. Not bottling it up, not pushing it away, but actually sitting with it. And it may take days, weeks, months, years. But actually, like, every time that emotion comes in, just be like, okay, this again, and sit down. Don't push it away. If you've got the time, just sit down and feel it. That's the big thing. That's like the secret. It sounds like nothing, but that's the big secret, because it's simple, but so many of us just avoid doing that.
Yeah.
We feel like, and this is where I would speak for men, we feel like choosing that is choosing weakness, and choosing to not adapt and not do anything about your life, but instead to just submit and be weak and accept and all of that. Because there's this anticipation that that feeling will just last forever and you're going to wallow in it. So I tried to make that clear when I spoke a little bit at that conference, that I was noticing a lot of people just wanting to avoid it. And that kind of way through was the big secret.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it was any different for me. It was exactly the same. It was, yeah, just going into the emotion. And so here's at least for me, what I noticed is that I used to have quite depression for quite a lot of years. And what would happen is that I would wallow on things, but it was just mostly in the head. And I would feel bad as well emotionally, but it was kind of, things were just, would loop, like things wouldn't resolve. It would be recurring. And then when I learned how to do meditation, where I would actually feel things in my body and I would focus on that, then the emotion would release. If I would just let go of the kind of mental train of thought of what this is about and what's the story of what's happening and, oh, poor me and all of that bullshit, and just feel how my body's feeling, it would release. So maybe, and I can't speak for other people, but maybe that could be part of why people feel like, you know, feeling their emotions, they're going to get stuck there forever, because they're not actually fully feeling them. They're just telling themselves the same story over and over. And it's the story that's producing emotions rather than feeling
the good
emotions
point.
Directly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything else to say about emotional processing, or should
there's two things actually I want to say. The first is that I can just imagine the comments section in the future, you know, two white Western people complaining about the hardships of their lives and talking about the depths of suffering. And so there's something I want to articulate here about suffering, because I have a lot of empathy for people in the world suffering at whatever level they're at. There's something about exposure that makes suffering easier. Like, if you've been exposed to a lot of suffering, things that would bother your friend who hasn't had any exposure are just not going to bother you. You're going to process that stuff easily, roll off your back, you know, stresses about work or whatever. If you're dealing with, you know, there's degrees. If you're dealing with the death of your mother or an illness or something like that, stubbing your toe, being late for work, getting yelled at, getting fired, that stuff is not going to be that big of an issue. So what I mean to say about that is, depending on what degree you're at, suffering is intense.
Yeah.
If you're not exposed to suffering very often and then you get something that comes in, it's very intense.
Yeah.
And it's almost as intense as something, you know, you're maybe getting fired from work, compared to someone who has had intense suffering. You know, the guy we interviewed on our podcast from Sudan.
Yeah.
Do you remember his name?
Emmanuel Jol.
Yeah. I mean, he was a child soldier in Sudan who had to survive by killing people he knew, people in his village, and had to resort to cannibalism. So his level of suffering, his bar for suffering is way up there. Mm-hmm. But so something really fucking horrible has to happen to him to get him to emotionally react in the same way that, you know, us Westerners would react to, like, I don't know, getting fired or something like that. But my point is that suffering is suffering. That's really it. And that our level of exposure is what's going to dictate what we're able to take.
Yeah, it's like it creates a baseline in a way.
Yeah.
And our baseline is our normal.
Yeah.
And whatever deviates from that normal is what we experience rather than, like, it. I mean, there are definitely certain things that are more traumatic than others. But
I just don't think it's a universal scale. Yes, I just think it's highly personal. Scale. And that's what I mean to say. And if you put someone, you know, if you do a medical, physical, medical examination of someone who's used to suffering and going through something particularly bad, and someone who's not used to suffering and going through something kind of meh, but really reacting to it, they're going to look, you know, by scale of degree, they're going to look kind of similar, you know, from a physical examination, from a neurobiological standpoint, they're going to look similar. Their degree of perception of suffering is going to be probably close.
We adapt to our environment.
Yes, thank you.
We adapt to.
So that was the first point I wanted to make. The second point was that this emotional processing is actually, a lot of us think it's limited to real experience. If I have gone through this thing, I am qualified to speak about it. What I don't think people realize is that you can process emotions for things that haven't happened yet. Like, you can know that your mother has cancer and is going to die in an amount of time. And you can go through that emotional grieving process. And I have personal experience with this. My mom had breast cancer 2 years ago, I think now. And it was not looking good. And she had to get multiple operations, tons of treatment, went through chemo, the whole thing. And it was just like really not looking good. And so I started to do that processing ahead of time because I recognized that, like, I'm in this space where this type of emotional processing is like something I know and something I'm kind of good at. And I recognized the necessity to start doing that so that I could potentially be there for my family as they had to deal with an event like that.
Yeah.
You know, to be the kind of strong force. I would probably have to be the one that steps up and deals with, you know, funeral and all that kind of stuff. So what I mean to say is I started doing the emotional processing ahead of time. And that's a real world example of the of an ability that I don't think people realize that they can process things that haven't happened yet. You can actually choose things. And so you can become emotionally resilient even though you don't have the actual real world experience. And that unlocks some interesting things. Mm-hmm. Like if you made a practice in your day-to-day meditation to meditate on these types of things, build it in, you're going to build resilience for events like the spread of this virus really reaching catastrophic levels. And people you know dying and civilization collapsing. Not saying that's going to happen, but I mean, you can actually do the emotional processing ahead of time and it will be such a boon to you and the people around you. You'll be so much more useful, effective. And it's what I've been saying from the beginning, like there's an end to this suffering. There's a processing of it and then a moving on from it that can be done purely through meditation.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Anything else to say on the subject?
I would like your opinion on this, actually, your input.
Well, it's similar. I mean, I don't have very much to add on that subject. It's definitely preemptive processing is useful, but I understand why people won't do it because it's really hard and it hurts. So a lot of the time people do it in response to something that happens, but it does prepare them for future things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same thing as, like, let's use investment, for example. You know, when you really go all in on an investment and you've put your savings into it, you can be really afraid, really emotionally invested in that thing. And you might make really dumb decisions out of emotions. You might sell early, you might sell late, you might buy early, buy late, you might miss curves, you might just absolutely obliterate your portfolio. Now, doing the emotional processing of being broke ahead of time, of destroying your portfolio and just being like, okay, I'm broke, I have nothing, will make you more detached from emotional decision making related to investing, and you might actually make better decisions as a result. This is basically the entire philosophy of Stoicism, which is something I'm diving into now. I'm actually really interested in Stoicism. It's strangely a basis of how I've been thinking without really realizing it for a lot of years.
Yeah. Is there anything else specific that you would want to cover in relation to COVID-19? Because I've actually lots of things to talk about. I just don't know how much time we have.
Oh, yeah, let's go. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have anything more to add about this, but I'd love to hear. Yeah, I wouldn't worry about time. Let's just go until we're done.
Yeah, I have notes here. Because there are a lot of specific things that I think are important to think about, because some of them, you know, people working in different fields can actually do something about it, and also in their own lives.
Are you talking about those notes?
Yeah.
There you go, just use that.
Oh, yeah, right. So we've talked about the different outcomes depending on the action and the tsunami versus the wave, supply chain disruption. So that's actually something that's already happening because a lot of things are manufactured in China, and because Chinese factories have been at a standstill for over a month now, and things are not getting shipped to other countries, and whatever people were buying in stores was just warehouse supply. And so now it's becoming very clear that this kind of globalized, hyper-efficient supply chain network that we had is not resilient to these kinds of events. So hopefully this is going to lead to more local manufacturing, which is actually really good for emissions, you know, for and for resiliency in different regions. When things, you know, when something like this hits, you know, things can respond a lot more quickly and efficiently. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What else?
What else?
We have I was kind of touching on for a while the
the economic
potential
effects.
Benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, economic recession. So that's something I want to touch on actually for a second here. Sorry, I'm looking at my cheat sheet. So there was a report recently. So in the States, they have laws against insider trading. So whenever founders sell their own shares in publicly traded companies, as far as I understand this, and please correct me if I'm wrong, they have to report it. And so what they found in the last few weeks, a lot of founders have started selling shares in their own companies. Hmm. So when people do that on an upswing, it's obvious they're just cashing in, you know, there's no kind of cause to worry here. But when they're doing it on the downswing, what that means is that they don't have faith in their own company, which is very, you know, it's quite serious. And usually what that means is that the country is about to go into a recession. And how long that lasts is not clear. But it's one of those kind of red flags that, people who are working in their own companies actually don't think that their company has good chances, at least for the next foreseeable future.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the stock market taking a huge dive, crypto taking a dive. And again, we don't know how long that dip will last. It could bounce back or it could go further. So obviously, there are societal repercussions to economic recessions. Certain people's businesses will, you know, go out of business. Whole industries might change. For example, the travel industry might never be the same after this. We don't know. People might just, you know, if these quarantine measures last a long time, it might actually mean that the whole travel industry will have to restructure itself. So there might not be as many flights. Or, you know, like what we've been doing with the digital nomad lifestyle, or people who travel for conferences, that might no longer be the norm.
Mm-hmm.
It might, you know, it might not only fall out of fashion, but just not become feasible. Because if there are not enough flights going, then the low-cost flights aren't going to be cost-effective for companies. Right. So they're not going to be offering them. So flights are going to cost more, and et cetera, et cetera. Cascades.
Yeah. Do you want to get into any positivity here? Because we've been pretty in the depths.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I know
one last thing on the negative repercussions is that the faith in government can really decrease in these events, and because it's personal for people, like it's not just, you know, oh, they screwed it up with this pipeline over there somewhere. And then you forget about it, you know, next week and you're on to the next thing. But when it actually affects your own family, it's personal. And that, you know, it can create kind of this resentment to the government for life in a person. So what can happen in these situations is that, it can happen what happened in Soviet Union, where basically it caused anarchy, where people just were no longer, like the government was just not significant at all, and then there was no government for a couple of years, and then, you know, there was a democratically elected president, but he still didn't have very much power. And then it was many, many, many years until, it wasn't until Putin came into power then that the government actually started having power again, and in people's minds as well, and in reality. So I'm not saying that this is what's going to happen, but it's something that can happen. And in Iran, for example, right now, the situation is really not looking good. And something like 10% of the parliament has COVID-19. So.
Crazy.
Yeah. But there are potential positive things that can come from this. So when people feel like something is really not working and it's personally affecting them, that's when things start changing. So we might actually see a change in governance. We might see more decentralized governance, more local governance, where people are able to participate in decision-making on things that matter to them, rather than having representative democracy, where it's this like very long and indirect chain of command, where people individually actually can't have any say in what happens on specific issues.
I could see an increase in the desire to have more locally sourced products and to kind of not be so reliant on globally sourced supply chains. That will probably be a change after this, especially when we all can't buy our stuff anymore.
Yeah, definitely.
I could see acceptance of remote work going up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's going to be a must to be able to keep businesses afloat and not spread infection.
Yeah,
and ones that are able.
Yeah, and when people can't travel for business meetings or for conferences, they're just going to do more things online through Zoom calls. And that is actually, you know, they're not using as much jet fuel to travel all around the world. So that's positive.
Oh, yeah. Did you notice the photos of Wuhan and other cities in China that are just like beautiful blue skies for the first time in ages?
Yeah,
that's pretty cool because the pollution's gone.
Because the factories aren't operating and people aren't driving.
Well, people
cars.
Aren't driving mainly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Homeschooling might become more accepted because they're shutting down a lot of schools and universities right now. Because children, it seems that they are just as likely to get the infection, but their symptoms are more mild, or they're completely asymptomatic. So they're just, you know, going to school and spreading the disease to each other and then to their parents.
When I think about the decentralization aspect, I mean, you've mentioned, I would think education would have to become more decentralized for us to have more global input and be more adaptive to the future, the demands of the future, whereas kind of the old schooling system is kind of still producing factory workers after 100 years of that model.
Mm-hmm.
So on the note of decentralization, that's going to be hopefully an interesting thing that we start reflecting on, is the necessity of decentralized governance, decentralized production of foods and goods. We've already got decentralized communication and to a degree finance, but I could see that to kind of distribute risk more over the network and not have things kind of built on these houses of cards. Mm-hmm. I could see that being a big change. But one thing I'm curious about is how do we have the benefits of what China has done to have that strict totalitarian quick move when we need it?
I don't think we can, but I think what we can do is create more community response teams. So, you know, people take CPR training. So something like that, where people get trained in basic medical response. When people get trained in, you know, like just basic preparedness for different kinds of disasters.
Well, the reason, I don't know if I agree, I may be a little utopian or far-fetched on this idea, but I do think distributed governance and decentralization in this, but having the benefits of the kind of China totalitarianism could exist. And the reason it's not, and it can't at the moment, is because we don't trust authority.
What do you mean?
I mean, liberal left, like liberal democracy has so much individualism built into it and such a lack of trust about top-down governance systems. So if we were able to have that level of power and strictness, but distributed in a way that only the internet could have ever allowed for.
I'm not really sure what you're saying.
Like, I don't know how exactly it would work, but some sort of distributed vote system where we vote on what needs to happen about how we respond to the COVID-19 outbreak. And if like experts within that system say, you know, lockdown, then that's what we do. I mean, and maybe I know there's models out there. I would say liquid democracy might be one of the better ways to do something like this, where experts have kind of like a heavier weighted vote on what to do. But then basically we would have more people participating in the system and then a strict enforcement of that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there. I know that that leaves a lot of room for
manipulation and popularity contests. Yeah, I'm not sure about that, but, you know, it definitely it gets people thinking about potential alternatives.
Yeah,
that could be more resilient and more anti-fragile to something like this happening. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some things that individuals can do. Because, you know, thinking about potential cool future governance systems is one thing, but when your own family is at risk, then that's a whole other situation. And when the time scale is like, it's happening now and next week and, you know.
Well, you made that list, so we should probably distribute that. I think the emotional, like, I don't even think it's worth talking about much else other than the emotional processing techniques. And we didn't really dive into those techniques, but it's like, to me, things are going to go wrong. You're going to be a lot more isolated if proper quarantine measures are actually going to be taken in Western countries. You're going to be at home a lot more. You're going to be dealing with the same kind of things people are dealing with in Wuhan, this kind of lockdown situation. I do think that's coming, unless we just don't respond and people die en masse to this disease. And it disrupts medical systems and just becomes a horrible disaster, which is also likely.
Yeah.
So either way, we're going to be dealing with a lot of really difficult things.
But it's possible to mitigate. And this is exactly, it's the same idea as like, is it going to be is it going to be a tsunami or is it going to be a tidal wave?
What I'm saying is either one is going to require that deep emotional processing,
sure,
the ability to do that.
There are other things that people can also do that
physically
are just as important. Right. Yes.
Okay, go for it.
So, first of all, work on boosting your immune system.
Yeah.
Because so many people live indoors, they're eating crap, they're, you know, drinking a lot of alcohol, and their immune system is crap. And this particular disease seems to be a lot more lethal to people who are immunocompromised. And of course, if people have a pre-existing condition, there might not be much they can do about that, but they can still do things to improve their immune system. So things like getting sunshine every day, that actually improves your ability to fight disease. It increases your vitamin D levels.
Except don't go outside.
Well, it's more about not interacting with other people, especially people who are sick. It's possible to go on the balcony or even just stand in front of a window, get some sunshine, if there is sunshine in your area. And even if it's cloudy, it's still better than nothing. Like, being cooped up inside is not going to improve your immune system. So vitamin C, you can supplement vitamin D as well, if you're going outside is not an option. Supplementing vitamin C as well has been, there's a new Chinese study that just came out that suggests that it might be an effective thing for viral infections. Western medicine still doesn't accept vitamin C as a viable treatment, but I suspect that it's probably going to be helpful, at least in some degree. Also, just having a healthy diet, not eating crap, if possible. Again, I understand that for some people, it's just not an option. You know, they can't afford maybe certain foods, but there's eggs and honey, raw honey and bone broth contain I forget the name of this compound.
Trust us, it's really sciencey.
Sciencey. No, I'm just, this particular thing I just learned this last week. I mean, I've known that bone broth is good for you, but I didn't remember the name of this compound. Glutathione? I'm mispronouncing it. But apparently it helps keep cells healthy for a long time. It prevents the breakdown of cells. So that's another thing that you can do.
You know what? Let's just link. Let's make a link now. So futurethinkers.org/COVID prep.
COVID prep.
COVID prep.
Or just COVID, because then it'll be also mitigation. I don't know what mitigation. This one. Oh, okay. Yeah, right. COVID prep. Okay.
That's yeah. Good. And that the link won't work right now, but in like, say, an hour, it'll work. Something mm-hmm. like that. Yeah. COVID prep. Yeah. And then you've got all of this information there already.
Yeah, right? I do.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And as far as, you know, people who are at risk, which is people over 50, people with pre-existing conditions like heart disease, cancer, respiratory diseases, things like that, it's probably best to avoid crowded places and avoid touching people and, you know, wash hands more frequently and disinfect surfaces.
If you want that, you know, we talked earlier about the necessity to update your models every day. This is something I wanted to touch on. I don't know if we've got time, and I don't really have my thoughts organized on this, but the idea of having to update your models every day and how to outsource your thinking in an effective way, how to create systems that effectively outsource your thinking and then be able to build the systems and maintain them. So if something fails, then you can update it. Maybe this is going to have to be a new episode. But check out Dr. John Campbell on YouTube. We can link to him in the document as well, right?
Yeah, I think he's got the best info on this.
And he releases the daily YouTube video. So that's a good source if you want to keep up to date on this, because things are changing every day. You're going to have to update your models. And having him as a source is actually quite good.
Yeah, and he's very level-headed. So it's not the same as, you know, media hype.
Yeah.
For broader stuff, I found Twitter actually to be really, really useful, because there are several virologists, epidemiologists, complex systems thinkers, who understand kind of the repercussions of this, and not necessarily projection, because nobody can say what's going to happen for sure, but they are able to talk about what could happen and what are some of the things that we can do on a societal level. So I found that super useful. And the hashtag is just COVID-19 or COVID-19. Both of them are trending. So you can check that out. Germinfo.org is currently the number one website for, it's an aggregate of all the most important news on what's happening. So yeah, if you want to go broader, you can check that out as well.
Cool.
So I think that's it for now. We haven't really checked out the chat, so.
Yeah, sorry, chat.
Sorry, chat.
yeah, a few other things. Fist bumps over handshakes.
Yeah, fist bumps. Or elbow bumps. Or the Wuhan handshake, which people just bump their feet. I saw a video of that.
That seems like a joke.
It was a joke, but yeah.
I'm not bumping feet. I might bump elbows.
Here, let's bump elbows.
Just like that. Maybe you do like a secret handshake. You just keep bumping elbows. What are we doing about this episode? Oh yeah, there's a new thing we're doing. So we're doing these live streams now every Monday.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
7 p.m. We're actually moving back to Canada. We live in Bulgaria right now. We're moving back to Canada in 2 months. The schedule is going to change then, which is going to make these live streams more available in the evenings for you guys in the West or in North America. And for these live stream episodes, you get to come in and watch the whole thing, but we're actually going to chop them up and release bits and pieces of them out there on the internet. If you want to get access to the full episodes or any past episodes that we've done, extras.
After they've aired.
And also, we've got over 100 episodes on the podcast, and we've got a lot of extras that have gone in the back end of our membership. Mm-hmm. Really good questions, really good answers from some really good people we've interviewed. So you can find all of those as well. And to get access to that, you have to get a membership at the site, and it's only $5 a month. So you'll be supporting us and supporting the show and helping us to produce this content. And then you get some really awesome stuff in the back end.
Yeah. So we're basically doing this to replace our Patreon so that we keep it in-house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't trust that Patreon censoring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially as we talk about more world events. Speaking of censorship, actually a bunch of my friends have been getting shadow banned on both Facebook and Twitter for talking about COVID-19 and especially whistleblowing about government's lack of response. So, you know, as we talk about these global issues more, I expect us to be demonetized on YouTube and probably shadow banned on social media, at least to some degree. So, yeah. Can't be doing Patreon anymore, so it's going to be on our site. So for $5 a month, you guys get access to these full episodes, to a bunch of extras that we've already been publishing for over a year from different interviews.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Are we going to do the discussion? I think maybe not this week, but every Monday we're going to do these live streams, and then we're going to do a discussion afterwards where you guys can come in and just chat with us. I don't think we're going to live stream it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're interested in joining us, then next week, I think. Do we want to do it today?
No, I think baby's screaming his head off.
Yeah, I can hear baby in the other room. All right. I think we're good. That's it. Thank you, guys. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye. If you like this content, you might want to check out our 7 Ways to Adapt to the Future guidebook. Get it for free at futurethinkers.org/signup. You might also want to check out our Future Thinkers membership area. We have courses there to help you adapt to the changing world, build resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose in your life. As well, you'll get access to our community, all of our unreleased content, private Zoom calls, live Q&As with guests, workshops and events, and more. Just go to members.futurethinkers.org. Every month we run a contest where we give away 1 month of the Future Thinkers membership for free. Check that out at futurethinkers.org/giveaway. And if you enjoyed this video, please like, share, and comment. It really helps out our show more than you know. And if you want more like it, then subscribe and hit that bell icon to be notified of new videos. See you next time.